Case number four is case A24-0456, Tracy Marie Desmond, petitioner appellant versus Michael Frederick Desmond, respondent. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will then have an allotment of 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. The lectern is adjustable in height. There are two buttons on the front edge of the surface, one to make it go up, one to make it go down, so feel free to adjust it to your preference before you begin. So, counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Mary Reynolds Rowan, appearing on behalf of...
So you may, if you are able, you should use the center lectern, which has a microphone. And you may, why don't you start over by introducing yourself and your client. Thank you.
Mary Reynolds Rowan, appearing on behalf of and with the appellant who's present in the courtroom today. Good morning, and may it please the court. I will begin with a summary of the questions to be raised on appeal. Number one, did the trial court abuse its discretion and err by awarding joint legal and joint physical custody despite the recommendations of the custody evaluator and evidence of domestic abuse between the parties? Number two, did the trial court abuse its discretion and err by requiring mediation between the parties for future legal custody disputes when there has been domestic abuse between them? And number three, did the trial court abuse its discretion and err by requiring court permission for international travel? We would submit that the answer to all three questions raised on appeal should be in the affirmative. The standard of review is whether the trial court abused its discretion, and we're relying upon the Pakula case. That was a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1985, 374 Northwest 2nd 705. The guiding principle in all cases is the best interest of the child under the law. And Minnesota Statute 518.17 provides that the court shall use a rebuttable presumption that joint legal custody is not in the best interest of the child if domestic abuse has occurred between the parties. We submit that the respondent did not sustain his burden in rebutting that presumption. Specifically, in determining whether that presumption is rebutted, the court shall consider the nature and context of the domestic abuse and the implications of the domestic abuse for parenting and for the child's safety and well-being and developmental needs. Joint legal custody should only be granted where parents can cooperatively deal with parenting decisions, as found by this court in 1995 in the Rosenfeld matter, 527 Northwest 2nd 724. With respect to the issue of mediation, Minnesota Statute 518.619, Subdivision 1, allows the court to refer parties to mediation, but provides a specific exception in situations where there has been domestic abuse. The court need only determine that there is probable cause that one of the parties has been physically abused by the other, and then the court shall not require mediation. This is under the Mechtel decision, 528 Northwest 2nd, 916, from this court in 1995. Courts review the application of that law de novo, and we submit that this was an error of law on the part of the district court. Even though the appellant may have at one point agreed to mediate limited issues with counsel, we don't believe that this negates the application of the law prospectively when referring the parties to mediation for future joint custody disputes. The parties were married on July 27, 2017, and they are the parents to three minor children: Michael, born August 18, 2017, Mason, born June 20, 2018, and Victoria, born January 28, 2019.
If I could, let's fast forward a bit to the custody issue. So what specifically should the court do or did not do in terms of finding that the presumption had been rebutted?
The court in this case relied heavily on the testimony of the respondent, and that testimony was significantly outweighed by testimony of numerous other individuals, law enforcement professionals, supervisors of the parenting time and parenting time exchanges, as well as the director of that program, the custody evaluator, the limited scope parenting consultant, my client, and even the respondent himself, who admitted to the domestic abuse under oath during the trial in this matter.
But then the court did go through the analysis after that. So I agree there was a finding of domestic abuse, but it's the analysis after that.
I would submit that in this case, the court erred by not taking into consideration all the weight and volume of the evidence. And in looking at that joint legal custody presumption, with the sufficiency of that evidence, it was not rebutted.
Sounds like you're asking us to second-guess the district court's determinations of the weight of the conflicting evidence?
Well, certainly we ask the court, when there's an abuse of discretion, if it's significant, that this court would look at all the evidence and determine not whether it would have made a different decision had it been sitting in the district court's position, but whether no other decision could or should have been made in that case. And we submit that here that's the case in light of all of the evidence that was submitted at trial. The parties did separate when the appellant obtained an order for protection against the respondent, and she served the summons and petition shortly thereafter in July of 2022. Now, the respondent violated this order for protection on numerous occasions, even as recently as within the last month, and often in front of the children. It resulted in 3 arrests and 2 criminal convictions, and most recently an additional criminal complaint against him for stalking. Respondent's parenting time was initially supervised and ultimately moved to unsupervised time with exchanges supervised only. Dr. Scott Fisher was the custody evaluator in this matter at trial. He recommended that the appellant be awarded sole legal and sole physical custody of the minor children. He testified extensively that the appellant had tried to set boundaries in communication with the respondent and was unsuccessful. He noted concerns of hostility from respondent to the appellant, and he even opined that the level of conflict was such that he didn't see it getting better due to the seriousness of the respondent's behavior problems. Dr. Fisher believed the appellant, but testified that he had credibility concerns about the respondent. He also testified that appellant's defensiveness in her psychological testing could have been a fear response as a result of the abuse. He noted, most importantly, that he was concerned that the children have been exposed to a high level of conflict in this case. Perhaps most telling is that there was not one instance presented to the trial court in which the parties effectively co-parented during the pendency of the dissolution. When the case was heard, there was significant testimony of the domestic abuse and the ongoing hostility that was directly impacting the children. The trial court acknowledged that the level of conflict was a huge issue affecting them, and she also found that the minor children were too young to express a preference, but then relied upon their expressed preferences when making her decision. We submit that this is also an abuse of discretion. Lee Novelli was the...
I just, to the extent you can, because we are functioning with this standard of review, abuse of discretion, and it's a difficult one, especially in a case like this, where there are such charged feelings, you know, on both sides, but certainly on appellant side, I understand. You talked about Dr. Fisher. He did, as I recall the record, say it was a close call even for him. And of course, the court has no obligation to follow the recommendation of the expert that the court appoints or utilizes, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So to the extent you can, you know, beyond just saying the terms it's an abuse of discretion, if you can just be as specific as possible, I would find that helpful.
Certainly, I would say that in this case, I acknowledge that Dr. Fisher testified it was a close call, but there was a lot of other testimony that's informed the court about the level of hostility and abuse that had gone on between the parties. And that, all of that testimony as well, fell in favor of the appellant. So Lee Novelli was the limited scope parenting consultant. She testified extensively that in the 5 months she was employed, the parties incurred $10,000 in legal fees with her, and she had to make 9 decisions in that short period of time. So that's another example of evidence that was disregarded by the trial court when looking at the totality of the circumstances.
I was left with the impression reading the district court's order, and I'd like to add your input, that she certainly recognized the domestic abuse and that it occurred in front of the children. But she seemed to be influenced to some extent by, she felt that respondent was contrite, remorseful, you know, seeking ways of being a better father, if not ex-husband. And the district court was sort of trying to leave doors open for improvement.
We would submit that that's not the appropriate course of action in this case, especially when the vast majority of the improvement that was seen only as a result of requirements placed upon the respondent as a result of his repeated offenses and convictions for violations of the order for protection. Even his therapist and the leader of the men's group that he attended testified that they weren't fully informed of the situation, and had they been, they would have been concerned about respondent as well. So even his own witnesses didn't provide that corroborating evidence. It was simply a reliance, we feel inappropriately, on in large part on the respondent's testimony.
But is that a credibility determination on the district court's part?
Well, I think when it comes to a situation like this where we have numerous professionals involved, all of whom are making recommendations and proposing evidence as well, that the credibility issue cannot be overlooked at this level. There simply was too much evidence in favor of the appellant for the court to have made that as a credibility determination alone. And we would submit as well that the respondent admitted himself to a number of these issues. This is an extreme case of concern, I would say, in terms of the behaviors that were exhibited and testified to at trial. He, the limited scope parenting consultant, additionally spoke with respect to concerns about the respondent speaking negatively about the appellant in front of the children, but she did not have the same concerns for the appellant. And she had additional concerns that she testified to with respect to his lack of impulse control and emotional stability. Despite this, the district court ordered joint legal and joint physical custody for the parties to engage in mediation in the event of legal custody disputes. And then this appeal resulted. There is no question, you're correct, that the court found that there was domestic abuse in the parties' marriage, as testified to by the appellant in detail during the trial. There were text messages where respondent acknowledged that he threatened to kill himself and to kill the appellant. He admitted to engaging in threatening behavior towards the appellant, and the appellant presented photographic evidence of the aftermath of one of the altercations, including bruising to her leg. This alone shows probable cause of the domestic abuse. The Scott County Sheriff's deputy testified about the appellant being afraid and the respondent's behavior while he was serving the order for protection. The deputy described the respondent as volatile and erratic. He also testified that while he was accompanying the respondent through the home to obtain personal belongings, the respondent was spitting on clothing and spitting on the walls. Respondent himself admitted to going to the appellant's home in the middle of the night and throwing rocks at her window in violation of the order for protection. The appellant even believed that the respondent came to her home additional times, which were being investigated at the time of trial. And even Dr. Fisher, the custody evaluator, testified that these were legitimate concerns in light of his behavior and offenses. The parenting time exchange supervisors were also witnesses at the trial and testified about the violations of the parenting time exchanges, describing respondents' stares as a heavy gaze that made them uncomfortable and gave them an uneasy feeling. They described his demeanor as combative, and ultimately, the services were suspended for his failure to follow the rules, something done very rarely in the history of that supervising authority.
Ms. Randall, so I guess before your time expires, I want to ask a question about the third issue you identified at the beginning, international travel. What exactly is your objection to the district court's, to that part of the order? I mean, in other words, which aspect of the district court's order concerning international travel do you believe was erroneous?
The requirement that the appellant or that either of the parties obtain permission for international travel before doing so, simply based on the fact that the appellant had family in California.
I guess, do you know, I mean, my understanding is that as a matter of federal law, one parent taking a minor child out of the country always requires the approval of the other parent. And it seems like the way the district court's order is written, it seems to acknowledge that. It says international travel for the children requires prior written agreement of the parent, and then continues by saying such approval shall not be unreasonably withheld. I'm just wondering what effect the district court order had, whether it really changed the status quo or whether it imposed any requirements on the parties that did not already exist.
I think that it did in this case in light of the respondent's behavior, because of the controlling nature of his behavior and the abuse, that to provide that he could withhold that consent, although it would not be unreasonably withheld, would be concerning because of what he had the way he had conducted himself during the pendency of the proceeding.
Your time has expired, but you will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent respondent Michael Desmond. This case really turns on credibility and the careful weighing of the best interest factors, both of which this court rarely, if ever, overturns and should not do so here. Mother's argument continues to focus on the bad things that father has done in the past, and he acknowledges he made some bad decisions in the past, but the trial court considered all of this and found that father was credible in his efforts to change his behavior and improve his behavior since the summer of 2022. And the trial court is in the best decision to, it's the best position to make those decisions and those credibility determinations. This court is not in a position to reweigh the evidence or second guess the credibility determinations. And I think if you look at the record, even looking at the judgment and decree or the transcript, especially where the trial court is talking directly to the custody evaluator, it's clear that it was carefully considering all of these things. And it found there was significant concerns that an award of sole custody to mother would have been harmful to the children, in that it would diminish the relationship with father. And it recognized there were pros and cons to joint custody as well, but it considered those, weighed those. That's quintessentially what we ask trial courts to do. And the fact that mother would have weighed them differently does not make it an abuse of discretion. The presumption against joint custody is just that. It's a presumption. It applies when there's no other evidence to the contrary. And the trial court considered it and found that it had been rebutted here. And then just to correct one thing, appellant has stated in her brief and here today that father did not meet his burden to rebut it. Neither party has the burden to rebut the presumption. That's clear from the Thornton case. Thornton versus Bosquez. It's not a burden that either party has to overcome. It's just a presumption, and the burden's not assigned to either party. But regardless, here the trial court did find that given the nature, the context of the abuse which happened, you know, during the breakup of their marriage where tensions are high, a lot of times people don't make the best decisions going through that type of a marriage breakdown. But then that there had been continued improvement for 18 months leading up to trial. Trial court found that, yeah, this presumption is rebutted and there are other circumstances which suggest joint custody is the best option.
Did the district court say which party rebutted or was it the passive voice?
I believe the trial court used the passive voice, but appellant has used the burden on father. So I just want to clarify that.
I'm looking at the order right now. It says, I think this is in the factual findings. The court finds the presumption against joint legal custody has been rebutted by respondent.
Okay.
Progress.
Okay. So I believe under Supreme Court precedent, neither party has the burden, but it appears that regardless, even if the trial court would have found that he met his burden, even if he did have the burden, which he does not have.
Could I ask Judge Hallbrooks for a page number?
Okay. The district court order.
Thank you.
Paragraph 36.
I want to reiterate, too, that the presumption is not a presumption in favor of the domestic abuse victim. It's a presumption against joint custody. So, and that's also from the Thornton versus Bosquez case. And so even if this court were to accept appellant's arguments that the presumption was not rebutted, the correct result would be to remand to the trial court to let the trial court decide which parent to give sole custody to. I think especially in this case where the court acknowledged serious concerns about giving mother sole custody, you can't assume that that would have been the result if it had found the presumption was not rebutted.
There is evidence in the record of father, like at the exchange of parenting time and the testimony about staring down the workers. Did the district court in the order give any consideration to the conduct during the proceedings?
So I think first of all, I would say that father denied those allegations. He denied that he was looking around the supervisor, and his testimony is evidence that the trial court could consider. I think that the trial court acknowledge those allegations when it said he's been reluctant to follow the strict guidelines of the parenting exchange supervisors, kind of acknowledging that they imposed very strict requirements and mother was arguing, well, he wasn't ready at exactly 7 o'clock, it was 7:03 or 7:05, those types of things. But I do want to point out that The types of complaints about his behavior after the summer of 2022 are of a completely different character than the complaints before the summer of 2022. So before, we're talking about serious allegations of threats and abuse. After, we're talking about, I don't like his facial expressions during exchanges. His demeanor is a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, it's undisputable his behavior has improved. Is there still room for improvement? Perhaps. And he's working on that. He's still involved in therapy. He's still doing the things he needs to do to continue to improve. But I don't think it's error for the trial court to say that the trajectory is certainly going in the right direction, and then therefore joint custody is appropriate. I want to talk to a couple of other arguments that mother has made as well. The consideration of the children's preferences, the trial court is clear that it's only considering them with regard to parenting time, not custody, and mother has only appealed custody, not parenting time schedules, so that's really irrelevant here. And even when it does talk about what the children's preferences are, it's not doing so in the sense of asking them what kind of custody arrangement they want. It's doing so, really, it just says, you know, the trial court's acknowledging that they love their father and it's in their best interest to have some time with him. I think that's appropriate regardless of the age of children. And the professionals had indicated that as well, that, yeah, it's in their best interest to spend time with their father. There's also been discussion about the inability to make decisions together. And the court did consider this explicitly in its decision, but found it was outweighed by other considerations. And this is not unusual. It's very common in divorces that during the dissolution process, tensions are high, it's very difficult to make decisions together. But after it concludes, things start to settle down and it becomes easier. And that's basically what the court's analysis here was. Given the trajectory so far, we expect things to continue to settle down and they'll be able to cooperate.
Is there evidence in the record to that point that they were cooperating?
So there's testimony from both father and mother that they're willing to. I think it was 515 of the transcript. Mother says, yeah, if it's ordered, I will cooperate, but I don't want to. And husband or father said that as well. Like, I'm willing to cooperate. There's evidence that they made decisions together before the dissolution process started, so presumably they can get back to that position as well. And I would note as well, with regard to the case law, where previous case law and previous iterations of the statute said that you can't order joint custody when they don't cooperate, that's no longer in the statute. And in fact, more recent case law says the opposite, recognizes that sometimes if there's going to be a lot of disagreement, it's better to do joint custody and let them bring their disputes to court rather than giving one party all of the power to make decisions. And so again, it's that weighing of what's going to be in the best interest. Do we you know, let them have joint custody so that they can hopefully cooperate, but if not, bring their arguments to court or to a neutral and get them resolved sooner rather than later, versus just giving sole custody to one party and then the other parent is really, you know, cut out of the equation altogether. There's definitely pros and cons to each, but again, that's what the trial court is asked to weigh, and that's what it did here. And there's no abuse of discretion with regard to that.
In bringing disputes to mediation, as the trial court required, is the order clear enough, or that the parties don't have to meet face to face?
Well, I think nothing in the order said that they have to meet face to face.
No, but the statute prohibits that, right?
Right.
If there's domestic abuse, and there is, the court shall not require the parties to meet and confer without counsel. And can you point to where in the order that it makes that clear, that if they have to go to mediation, that it's not just the two of them?
I think I would suggest you read the order in connection with the statute, and that would tell the parties you don't have to meet face to face. If it's ordering mediation, obviously it can't order it without being face to face. So I don't think anybody is going to object to having a not face to face mediation if that's necessary in the future. But I don't think that's the. I'll leave it with our arguments in the brief on that one. And then lastly, briefly on regard to international travel, I think the questions from Judge Johnson were right on point. There's no concern here about being unnecessarily controlling because the judgment decree states it cannot be unreasonably withheld. And so if there was some sort of dispute about whether permission was being unreasonably withheld, they could raise that argument and seek permission from the court or other mechanisms.
Do you know if my understanding of federal law is correct?
I haven't researched it with regard to this particular case, but I generally have the same inclination. I think that's probably true.
Thank you.
Were the references to the appellant taking the children to California, is that part of the evidence that's outside the record in this case?
So I would say this. It happened after the judgment and decree was entered. It is in a court record, so I think the court can always take judicial notice of court orders. But I don't think you need to get there. I think regardless of what happened after the judgment decree, the restriction on international travel is not an abuse of discretion, so I would suggest that's the easiest way to resolve the issue. But our argument would be that, yeah, the court can consider the fact that she did take the children and abscond to California afterwards, which we raised.
By no means is that international.
It's not international, but it's also not within what she was allowed to do under the order. And so the
art. Is there a prohibition against travel in the order?
Well.
Domestic travel?
Well, certainly there's a prohibition against domestic travel when you have no intention of returning the children and you're taking them away from father's parenting time, which is what happened.
Right. But I think that is outside the record.
Right. Yeah. Right, but my point is, in appellant's initial brief, there was a comment with regard to international travel that father's fears that she would abscond with the children were completely irrational and not supported by anything else in the record. And so that's why, in response to that, I mean, we felt we had to at least point out, look, she did do just that right after the judgment and decree. Again, I don't think that the court needs to go there to resolve the issues in this case, but it is a fact of record in the trial court's subsequent orders, at least. If there are no other questions, respondent would ask that the trial court be affirmed in its entirety.
Thank you, Ms. Kuhl. Ms. Rannells, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Just briefly, I'd like to point out that the district court did contradict itself in its findings in stating, I quote, the litany of inappropriate conduct, language, threatening behavior exhibited by respondent toward appellant was extreme and often in front of the children, but then noted that there have been no more recent incidents that would indicate that he would continue to commit acts similar to that, but then almost immediately contradicted itself and found that the respondent continued to demonstrate a high level of hostility toward the appellant. Additionally, the respondent's credibility would have been called into question as he asserts in his own brief that there is evidence that he can follow orders because he has no probation violations. But we would submit is that he had 3 arrests and 2 convictions for violations of the order for protection, as well as numerous violations of the parenting time exchanges. This is a case that, even with all of the professionals involved, required that respondent be instructed to end the visit at the door of his home and not even watch the children from his window after they leave the home because of his behavior. And I think that's an important thing to note. Opposing counsel notes that he is still working on his counseling and therapy and trying to improve, but what this court has to evaluate is the evidence that was before the trial court at the time of the decision, not what has occurred since then. It has to be based on what he had done and not what might have been or what might happen in the future. Citing that not one party should be given all of the power in a joint legal custody decision negates the statute that prohibits this kind of situation. And it effectively requires my client to engage counsel for future mediations where she should not have to do that. The fact that she may have agreed at one time to limited mediation shouldn't negate that statute in its entirety.
But the statute is about, it prohibits the parties meeting face-to-face without counsel, right? That's
correct.
The prohibition. And so the court could order mediation with counsel if the order is specific enough to that.
And I don't believe that the court did that. The court simply ordered mediation.
Okay.
In this case, the fact that the district court largely credited the respondent's testimony but that his testimony was refuted by nearly every other witness, including numerous professionals at trial, is important. There was no sea change of behavior to justify the court's finding and decisions. The domestic abuse by the respondent should preclude an award of joint legal custody or any requirement for mediation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reynolds. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. That concludes our fourth and final case on today's oral argument calendar, so the court is now adjourned.
All rise.